and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Carlotta Ribello. Coming up on this week's program...
I think that without risk, you aren't tilling new soil. You are doing what you've been trained to do.
Housing is and will continue to be one of the greatest demands as the population moves more and more to cities.
How do we balance a lot more residential buildings, but also with buildings that are going to be providing quality of life?
I don't know how future people will think about it, so I just do my best.
This week, we bring you a report from ReSite, a two-day conference in Prague under the theme Accommodate. From businesses to homes and people, how should cities be planned to ensure there is enough space for everyone? Join us as we hear about housing solutions for the millennial generation, the benefits of bringing nature into design, and the lasting legacy of adding a building to a cityscape. Plus, rethinking our urban landscape through dance, with a twist. That's all coming up over the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Carlotta Ribello. So welcome to this week's episode. Today I'm bringing you a report from Prague as we attended the ReSite 2018 conference, where global architects, planners and city leaders all gather to try and answer some of the biggest questions on housing in the 21st century. I started by speaking to the architect Dara Huang, who's the founder of Design House Liberty, an architecture and interior design practice based in London. Dara has just embarked on a new project called Viva House, targeting specifically the millennial generation, and she asks us to rethink our own definition of home. But proposing a co-living and co-working solution is not easy, and there's still a lot of stigma around the concept of a micro-home. She started by telling me exactly what Viva House is all about.
We obviously have a huge crisis in housing right now, and I'm only really focusing on the millennial demographic because it is the biggest demographic that's going to be in the world in the next coming few years. It already is in the United States. And so to find a solution where they can live viably in city centers was really what we're targeting. So Viva House is a rapid supply solution that we're right now exploring, which is exactly that, trying to take out all the bottlenecks that keep affordability from happening and solving each issue. So like you said, taking available space, and we're finding that there's a lot of empty commercial space at the moment just due to e-commerce and change in the office market. And as I said, very traditional programs kind of dying out, like let's say movie theaters are closing down in London, and then how to reconvert those spaces into mixed-use programs, which include a living aspect.
So the idea is that nowadays the only empty spaces that are in a city centre is when a big commercial venture shuts down, either cinema or department store or an office building that then is vacant. And what you're proposing is that you then, instead of continue that building to serve that commercial purpose, to use that big open plan space for actual living. How would it work?
With all these programs kind of shutting right now, I think that it's not just a reinvention of housing, it's just that housing is and will continue to be one of the greatest demands as the population moves more and more to cities. I'm not saying that housing is the only solution, because I think a lot of people are repurposing commercial spaces into serviced workspace. But what's happening is there is an oversaturation in that right now. It's now 35% of the London market, and what we really need is housing. So it's not something that works in silo. You know, we can't just make things up and then expect them to happen overnight. It's a project that works mainly with governments and planning, and it's basically taking commercial spaces and then creating a modular housing system in there. And so we're doing that by basically popping up homes within a big open floor space. And of course, there is a shared economy so that they would have shared kitchen and living spaces, simply because the unit economics makes it cheaper for rent. And because we set up so quickly and we're an asset-light concept, we're able to really kind of disrupt construction, and in that sense, that it means that rents can be a lot more affordable because it just happens much quicker.
How do you convince a developer or a government official to support you and realize that this might be a solution?
Well, that's a really good question. And the thing is, right at this moment, I don't have to convince anybody because I'm my own client. We've raised our own capital. We find our own sites. And I think that's one thing that is really great about this time and moment. And when I say this time and moment, I mean being young and being creative, because I don't think we've harnessed as much respect as we have now. And this society has always been like, oh, the funds make the decision, or capital or developers make decisions, but right now it's the people make the decisions, and this is due to digital technology. And if you can amass enough demand in people, then you can kind of create what you want to. And right now, you know, just developing isn't enough. It's like creativity is what people want. People want to live within certain environments or certain brands or certain concepts. And I think traditional real estate is even in a moment where they're searching for answers because things aren't stacking. They can't make projects viable. There's no working feasibility. And even the traditional living models right now, they're still asking, like, did that work? You know, did those 550 units that I designed and delivered for the developer in London, they're asking me, like, are the numbers stacking? You know, so there's this huge question on, like, what is viable? And they're not looking at it from a completely creative perspective, the way I am able to look at it, because I'm so much closer to the projects. But that's also why I've partnered with somebody in tech and finance and operations, because she's looking at all the background numbers that a traditional developer would look at. But I also just want to encourage young people and designers to really step out of their comfort zone and think about these solutions, because traditional real estate won't. So I guess going back to your question, how do I convince them? We don't have to at this moment because we're our own client, but going forward in our business plan, we would joint venture with other developers, which means that they'll already have a platform that they can see and numbers that are transparent. We're working on pretty good margins right now, and that's attractive. So I think as soon as our first site is up, I don't think raising money and convincing people will be a problem, like, at all. It's just a very obvious solution, and it's something that I want to encourage creatives to come out and sell, because it's not just single millennials that need housing. It's also families. It's also couples. It's a bunch of different demographics. So it'd be good to solve for many of them.
You're about to get the first site in London. When is that planned to be ready and up and running?
So yes, the first site is in London because that is where we're from. So because it is our first site and it is innovative and it's revolutionary and it's not bread and butter, it does take a while to get things going. It's innovative, so no one really knows how to wrap their heads around these things. And anyone will tell you that you do kind of have to find your lines to align with before things are kind of set in stone. So that being said, we can't guarantee a certain timeline, but I think a realistic timeline for us probably would not be until end of next year. And that's simply because, well, our product is ready to go, but we now need to produce all of them. And they are all prefabricated. So they're being made in the UK. And then it's about the legal processes, because we do not want to be under the radar. We don't want to be illegal. We are not a guardian business. This is a real business. It's a scalable business. So yeah, that's the projection at the moment.
That was Dara Huang, the founder of Design House Liberty. Now, what defines a home doesn't come down to just pretty buildings and innovative housing solutions. In the end, it's the community, the neighborhood, and everything else that comes in between that makes a certain area feel familiar and leaves you at ease. This idea of engaging the community is a core part of Elizabeth Streb's work. She's best known for walking down the roof of London City Hall back in 2012 as part of her piece Skywalk. Elizabeth believes in the higher role choreography can have in impacting a city, and most importantly, our perception of it. When she founded the Streb Lab for Action Mechanics in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, over 10 years ago, one of the first moves was to open up rehearsals to the public. The goal was to engage with the people and businesses around her while challenging our own relationship with the built environment. I asked Elizabeth about her work and how to train yourself to brace for impact.
I guess looking in from a distance and comparing us with other inventors in the dance world, I fit the bill of being a daredevil. But the people I've admired in my life in terms of looking to them for action information, like Evel Knievel, like Shipwreck Kelly, like Cannonball Richards, like all of the heroes that got in the barrel and went off Niagara Falls, for instance, the slapstick artists, I feel that they're considered kind of lowbrow humor. But, I mean, what is really funnier than putting a 2x4 on your shoulder and turning around? Like, there is something so deeply classical about those artists. And I guess I've admired them more than a lot of the dance artists that I grew up with. And also because I started dancing at 17, not 3. I was already an athlete and an extreme action person in various ways. So I think we believe danger is a critical component of the art of action, just like Shakespeare believes tragedy can't be left out of the picture.
Do you think risk is essential then for the work you do?
I do. In movement terms, we discover extreme events and we don't think we know them before we hit upon them. But I think that without risk, you aren't tilling new soil. You are doing what you've been trained to do. I thought technique was to train your body so it could do anything, not to perform technique. And I think that I do criticize dance just as a dialectic because that's my field. And I have to hit against something as people and artists and thinkers in every field hit against those that came before them. So I really think that without risk, it is just a pseudonym for trying something new or for trying to figure out what a really good question is that you can then be confused by for a long time in your experiments. But eureka, you come up with something that makes people's hearts soar, possibly.
Your company also has a school side of it as well. How do you train someone to brace for impact?
We're having auditions, and we do that every year and a half or so. And we look for those people, the people who are curious, are thinkers, are willing to not take too good care of themselves. They're not so worried about their own welfare. They're willing to get a little hurt. So the fussiness of carefulness physically doesn't fit into the Streb SLAM model. And SLAM is our studio in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, standing for Streb Lab for Action Mechanics. It's where we invent. In terms of the kids, we start them at just a year and a half, 18 months, and then we have classes going all the way up into adults, no age limit at either end. And we think we're teaching them to fly, but it's an actual technique called pop action. And I think we have about, just in the space itself, 1,300 kids and adults coming in and out of that every week. And so I am trying to infect the next generation to come with the belief that action is a critical part of people's experience in life. And it just brings joy and makes you braver and ups your esteem for your own self. Because you can go out onto the street and say, I flew today, did you? Kind of thing.
You earlier were telling me how the rehearsals are open to the public. Why do you feel that's a crucial part of the work you do? Why did you make that decision to open it up so that people could see the work you do?
When I got this particular garage after working in New York for a couple decades, I just started to make different decisions about analyzing where my money came from as a not-for-profit in America, in New York City. And I realized it comes from the federal government, the city government, the state government. And I started to think, well, it should be public. I thought it was correct to be public. And I wanted to go back to letting strangers in and the notion of interruption in the doors so that we weren't working in the ivory tower anymore. We were working in public. And it's not that thousands came in, but I offered first not what I thought my work would bring to them, because how pretentious could that be? But I offered the bathrooms and drinking water as a first line of invitation and just did it virally, like word of mouth. And I think the first time I saw the Con Ed person, the electric meter reader, come in and use the bathroom and not read the meter, I was like, yes, that's what I wanted. Slowly but surely, people, the word is out. We've been there 15 years. And the fact of having people we don't know watching us in rehearsal is as profound as performing a finished piece for an audience of 2,000 or 500.
What do you feel in terms of your work has been the biggest risk you've taken? I mean, the first time I saw you was at the London City Hall, and I could not believe it. So if there's anything that you feel that's a bigger risk than that, I want you to tell me.
Oh, no, let me see. Well, you know, everything is scary leading up to it. Once you get your harness on and go to the top of City Hall in London and get attached to the rope, you just have to walk. And I was just hoping I wouldn't fall. That's what I was hoping. But then once you start moving, and anyone who knows movement knows or has wisps of this as they're walking around the world, it's 100% a present tense technique. You are in this place. I was in this place like 250, 300 feet above the ground. Oh my gosh, the sky and the birds and the planes and the people. And it was a holy experience. I've done things like dive through glass. I've been on fire. That was an accident. I was trying to put the fire out with my body. I thought that would be cool. I've tried to show something very abstract but powerful about what it means to land. We fall from 30 feet and land, yes, on a mat, but we're abruptly stopped at the speed of gravity. And there's something about impact, I think, that is never, you don't really get used to it, nor do you ever get tired of doing it. And personally now, I've been not a practitioner for a number of years. I stopped when I was 47, and I'm 68 now. But I sometimes let extreme things happen to me, like walking down that building.
That was the choreographer and daredevil Elizabeth Strapp. This is The Urbanist. You're listening to The Urbanist on Monocle 24. I'm Carlotta Ribello, and this week we're reporting from the ReSite conference in Prague. One person that firmly believes architecture can shape how you relate to a city is Jeannie Gang. The architect and founder of Studio Gang spoke about the importance of public space. And while, yes, it is essential to address the housing crisis, cities should also be doing more to promote more interaction between citizens, be it through squares, parks, or something else. But as it gets increasingly more expensive to live in urban centers, does the growing upwards and outwards model still work? Jeannie told me about the importance of vertical buildings and why planners should aim to incorporate more nature in their structures.
I think it's important to figure out how to design more vertical buildings. It's already happening, obviously, everywhere, going from buildings that were one and two stories to now three, four, five, and then further in cities that have tall urban downcores. It doesn't mean that a historic core needs to have skyscrapers. It just means that as we need to accommodate more people in tighter quarters to make density happen, yes, we need to explore vertical buildings.
Do you believe that a new building in the right neighborhood can really change that area? Can it be the driving force to change an entire neighborhood? Imagine if you suddenly have a building that will house like 200 people or more, I don't know how many families. That's a lot of people that will suddenly move into a new area of town. Mm-hmm. So can a building, I guess, become what drives change in a place?
Mm-hmm. Well, for sure, we can see that. Even if it's not a building with high density, a new building that brings a spark to a neighborhood can catalyze change in a place. And so I think it's a question of how do we balance a lot more residential buildings, but also with buildings that are going to be providing quality of life and outdoor spaces too. So housing can't really sit on its own. You know, it needs to be surrounded with work and culture and nature in the city together.
You mentioned nature there, and we start seeing more and more now the trend of the vertical gardens, you know, vertical buildings incorporating lots of greenery. It is essential to think about nature as well and green spaces when we're building new things. What is your opinion on this trend of the vertical gardens?
Well, for me, I like to weave together diverse nature and the city. So not just nature meaning, okay, it's a green grass, open lawn, because that's really only a monoculture and it can't support a lot of different life. And as city footprints get bigger, it's more and more important that we accommodate a wide diversity of wildlife within our cities. So you need lots of different kinds of environments, different plants. What I've been experimenting with on my own office in Chicago is we've created what we call a sky garden. And that means it's not just a green roof. You know, it is a roof that's planted with something like 48 different species of plants. There's pollinators, bees, trees. We even have bats. And we're monitoring the life, including the life in the soil up on our rooftop. So I'm envisioning, you know, the future as a place where buildings are the infrastructure to hold gardens, biodiverse gardens, including the tall buildings and having plants within them. But this is really one way that we can really incorporate living material into our everyday life.
For our listeners that might not be familiar with the benefits and why it's a good thing to do that, could you just explain?
Yes, because there's a web of life and everything is interconnected. So if you have just, you know, a simple park with one kind of grass on it, you're not really supporting this interconnected web of life, which we all need to live a healthy life. So the reason why pollinating bees and birds and insects are important is because they are creating this ability for the plants to produce. There's all kinds of reasons why. One is for the pleasure of seeing nature's diversity. One is for the health of human beings. Like, for example, did you know that if you eat honey from a specific area, you can totally reduce your allergic reactions to pollen in the air? So there's many things that we know that are more and more important for human health, but also health of our environment. And these are resources that need to be valued, and they also bring pleasure. So yeah, this is the trend. I've been working on it since I started my office and for the last 20 years, and we've gotten more and more advanced at doing it. So I see that European cities are starting to think about this, but really it hasn't been in the equation for very long.
Where do you get your inspiration from? I know it's a big question, but I'm always curious about the method and where it comes from.
Well, I'm an information junkie, so I like to research. My team and I do a lot of research on every project, whether it's about the city, about the place. We even talk to everyday users of buildings prior to the design. We do a lot of research. And in that process, something always sparks the imagination. And then really I take it from there and start to make things based on what I know. So my process involves a lot of reading, research, creative making, and the project evolves out of that. After this kind of research phase where we go off in a lot of different directions and bring information back, then there's a phase of just putting that to the side and making things. So whether it's digital modeling or physical modeling, and we start to try to embed those ideas into the things we make. But, you know, you also have to be open to that process of making, and that might take you in a different direction. But my theory is that there's still intelligence in the things that you're making if you have done the research beforehand.
Now, there's this idea that architects are writing history of the city when they add a building to it, because it will live on, at least hopefully, for many generations to come. When you're working, is it always at the back of your mind that idea that your projects and your work is going to be another dot and word in the history of that city?
It's hard to predict how many years to come things stay, but one thing is important is that every time I design a building in a new city or in an existing city, it's always in dialogue with other buildings that are already there, landscapes that are there, physical features that are there. So there, I try to create a dialogue between this new building and something that's come before it. And it would be great if all buildings could last a very long time. But I think what we're seeing now is that it's not only how you make the building, how enduring you make it and how well built it is. Change comes for many different reasons. Change could be because the real estate value increases and a big building that was very expensive could be torn down if something bigger is to be built. So there's a lot of invisible forces that impact the longevity of architecture. My goal is mainly to make a building that can serve its purpose well and last and age well and take as little energy as possible.
That was the architect and founder of Studio Gang, Genie Gang. And before we head off, I also had a chance to catch up with the Japanese architect Su Fujimoto. Designing an urban area that works for everyone is not an easy task, and perhaps using a standard model for housing, it's not the best solution. As cities evolve, how will something that is built now be looked at in the future? And what role should an architect play in writing that story? Here's Su.
The micro housing, so the sharing and something, all of those kind of things should be the solutions. And I believe we should have the different variations and the diversities, because I don't like to have the one specific answers. Then it is like a dominating everything, and this is disaster. And then, for example, in Tokyo, it's already like a really crowded, but still they have like a various different types of the different living, the two stories independent houses around, and then housings, and then tiny housing and shared housing. But the things that Tokyo doesn't have is more like a varieties of the open public spaces. So probably, I hope the diversities of the scales, diversities of the densities, diversities of the different types of the relationships to each other could make more choices for people. And if some people, for example, for me, likes to have such a tiny, tiny houses, it's okay for me, or I prefer that. It's almost like a capsule, like things. Is okay for me, but for some people, they don't like it. And then it could be more like open shared spaces could be okay. So I just like to have such a varieties and the diversities.
When you then are thinking about this future of city living, does it get then to the point that what needs to be rethought is just what consists of a house and a home in the end, mm-hmm. rather than anything else?
I like to have those mixtures of different kind of the historical heritages. And if they think this is the apartment house, this is like the living spaces, the kitchen, the three bedrooms and something like that, that is also interesting, but it gets super expensive sometimes. And then shared with some people, that same space is also fine. But then proposing 5 square meter apartment for each person, almost like a shelves, could be also fine. The things I don't like to do is cleaning up everything and then bringing something new, but more like a coexistences or mixtures of different lifestyle must be needed. And then I like to respect those kind of a cultural continuity, because cultural continuity doesn't mean it should not be changed, keeping such kind of the heritages, but at the same time bringing something new to that to test how it works. And sometimes it works, but after 20 years, these options, which doesn't work now, could work in a sense. Then historical, beautiful, complex story is happening now. So I have such a mindset that they're open to every possibilities and try to do what you think good for the future. And then the future people will arrange again for another future. So those kind of the consequences or sequences of the futures or the continuity of the trials must be something. I don't believe any strong one answer for that.
You think it's essential for and crucial for an architect to have that always in the back of their mind, that respect for what was there or the history of a place and cultural heritage?
Well, I think so. I think because architecture is making kind of the history, and whatever we make, it's part of the history, positively or negatively. And then the next generation will see it and then we'll make the positive or negative criticizing in a creative way and then making another history. So we are already part of the history. Then not only just thinking about the future, but then thinking about the whole history and the continuity of the life is crucial for me.
So adding a building to a city is almost like adding a couple of words to a history book.
Yeah, that's true. That's not a nice way to describe it.
Does it ever stay in the back of your mind, the idea that generations to come, long after we're all gone, your work will still be there? Is that something that when you're putting together a project and deciding what to do, that it's on the back of your mind, that in many, many years, it will be there, a testament of your work?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, yes, true. And of course, not only physically, but as an idea or as a concept, it will be part of the future world. I don't know how future people will think about it, so I just do my best to create something valuable for the future, and then they will see.
That was the Japanese architect Su Fujimoto. And that's it for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was reported and produced by myself and edited by David Stevens. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here is Edward Sharp and the Magnetic Zeros with Home. Thank you for listening, city lovers.